You just may have gotten a little lucky this morning. Dr. Benson used to say he'd love to hear a one-armed preacher. At least he couldn't forever say, "and on the other hand." And it might have some favorable impact on the length of the sermon. At least there's hope. I'd like to begin with a questionnaire this morning, and you really don't need a pencil or a piece of paper. It'll just take one word to answer each question. Maybe the same word will answer them all. But a questionnaire, I think, is especially appropriate on a Labor Day weekend. Are you satisfied with the work you're doing about 2,000 hours a year? Do you have a sense of achievement with what you do with your days and nights? Are you satisfied with what you're paid for what you're doing? Is your boss fair in his or her treatment of you? Do you really wish you could change jobs? If you had the opportunity, would you change quickly? If you've answered no to most of those, some are turned in the wrong direction, you may well have shown that a significant part of your life is frustrating to you. It has become drudgery. In 1882, a man named Peter McGuire, who was the founder of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, thought a lot of people in America were not receiving proper appreciation for their work. That because of this, work had become drudgery, tedious, sometimes dangerous. And he supported the beginning of Labor Day. He organized a Labor Day parade for New York City. And through continual working year after year, by 1894, several individual states had adopted an annual holiday of Labor Day. And President Cleveland signed it into national law. It has become law in Puerto Rico and Canada, as well as in the United States. It seems appropriate that at least once a year we stop and think about all the people we depend on for work they do that in many instances we could not do, in other instances we wouldn't want to do. Think of the people who mine minerals that in one way or another we're dependent on, or the people who build automobiles that transport us constantly, or the folks who are responsible for making clothes or raising gardens, farming, or the garbage collectors, or the police and the firemen who protect us in various ways. We who live in the city are as dependent as any people in history have ever been. We wouldn't be able to make it alone. It's appropriate that we stop, and especially for the people who do find their work either dangerous or tedious, say thanks for what is being done. But let's go back to you and your job. If you live all week for the weekend, if you live years for retirement, just can't wait till it gets here, pretty good sign that the 90,000 hours you're probably going to invest in your work within a lifetime could have been invested in a better way, something more meaningful for you. What can be done about it? How can a person approach it? What can be done for my work or yours on Labor Day besides showing appreciation to other people? There's a good bit of writing in the last couple of years, especially on Japanese corporations and what they've been able to do for their workers to apparently make them more productive than American workers, generally speaking. The automobile industry, the steel industry, the electronics industries have perhaps suffered more than others have, but there seems to be a general awareness that Japanese people who've copied our technology in many instances have done a more successful job producing it than we've done of late. One of the ways they apparently do it is by promising a lifetime employment to a person who goes to work with this or that company. The cemetery may even be on the grounds. You'll be taken care of. No matter what happens, you will have a job. You will be cared for even in death. Another instance of what they've been able to do to get people to be more productive is by asking for suggestions and then taking them seriously. Person who works on the line is able to see something that could be improved, and when that's reported, meaningful change is made. There are ways corporations can help, and one of the bright spots, I think, in the labor scene today is that corporations have become more aware of this and more concerned about it. And yet, truth is that no matter what the corporation does, Your attitude is crucial to whether or not you enjoy your work. Corporations can only go so far. Attitude is an inner thing. If you're locked into what you do for the rest of your life, and many people are, the only hope for change is within you. If you can't change the job, you have to begin working on yourself. I don't know how one best does that. There are many people who have attempted it in the past. Thomas Carlyle, in the 19th century, wrote to his mother, who was a rather hardworking woman, and commented about a lady in his acquaintance whom he called Lady Sandwich, a lady who apparently had things made financially, didn't work, but he said, she has plenty of money and fair health, but alas, nothing to do. That's not a very easy life after all. Well, it wouldn't be for me. And Carlyle had observed that it wasn't for this lady. Carlyle also wrote, blessed is the man who has found his work. Let him ask no other blessing. I'm not really sure how much a 20th century audience is edified by a poem from the past. But it may be that in Henry Van Dyke's appreciation for work, there's something that could help you or me appreciate our work a little more fully. He said, let me but do my work from day to day, in field or forest, at the desk or loom, in roaring marketplace or tranquil room, let me but find it in my heart to say, when vagrant wishes beckon me astray, this is my work, my blessing, not my doom. Of all who live, I am the one by whom this work can best be done in the right way. Then shall I see it not too great nor small to suit my spirit and to prove my powers. Then shall I cheerfully greet the laboring hours and cheerful turn when the long shadows fall at eventide to play and love and rest, because I know for me my work is best. The key here is finding something that I can find meaningful in my work. After the early service was over this morning, a gentleman left who said, I'm employed at what appears to be a pretty low wage, and he told me his salary for a year. But he said, if you figure it out, it's twice minimum wage. He works in a very important hub in our city and explained that his specific job is in a painter's quarters. He's the fellow who cleans up the buckets and lays out the drop cloths. But he said, if I weren't there doing what I'm doing, the shop would look like a cyclone had hit it all the time. He's found a great deal of satisfaction in what he's doing that might not challenge someone else among us. But the key is the inner satisfaction, seeing meaning in what you're doing. Many of you, I'm sure, know the Foxfire books, the series. Foxfire is a little flower that grows in the Appalachian region. And the books came to be written because a few years ago, a high school teacher in that area organized some high school students to go out and interview elderly people about how life one time was in the Appalachian Mountains. Many of the people they talked to were above 90 years of age. But the students noticed as they talked with them, there was a real gleam in the eye when they began talking about days when they built cabins with their own hands. When they made their own clothing on their own looms, when they raised their own gardens with their own hands, when they butchered hogs and cattle for their meat. The young people began to realize that even though they wouldn't want to go back and live like that anymore, these people found satisfaction using a tool God had given them, the hands, a satisfaction that's often lost from life today. And the depth of their satisfaction is revealed in the number of Foxfire volumes that have come and the avid readership for them across the country. We have a nostalgia for the past, but we really want life to count. And we have a feeling that life counted for these people in a way that it may not be counting for us. One of the things that stood out to the high school students in their interviews was that these people were nurtured by the Bible. And many of them in their 90s were still reading the Bible avidly on a daily basis. And that their view of work had developed from the Bible's view of work. The 90th Psalm is one instance of this. It's the only psalm in the collection that's attributed to Moses. It's a beautiful psalm. Had I warned Jim ahead of time I was going to use it, no doubt he would have sung Isaac Watts' O God, our help from ages past this morning. But Moses begins the psalm with an address to God, exalted, beautiful language. Lord, you've been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. But having given his exalted address, starting with God, who was always there and who brought everything into being, by verse 5, he's thinking about the brevity of human life. You sweep men away in the sleep of death. They're like the new grass of the morning. Though in the morning it springs up new, by evening it's dry and withered. And before long, he's thinking about the harshness of it all. Haven't you sometimes thought about the harshness of it all and wondered whether it was really worth it? All our days pass under your wrath, verse 9. We finish our years with a moan. The length of our days is 70 years or 80 if we have the strength. Yet their span is but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. The striking thing about the psalm to me is none of that. Not the beauty of the address to God. We have a lot of that in the Psalms. Not even the harshness of human life. We have a good bit of that in Scripture. But a line that is unique in Scripture with which the psalm ends. The way the psalmist can move all the way from how wonderful God is to where we live and work. So the last verse says, may the favor of the Lord our God rest upon us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. If we could just paraphrase that into our own language, the psalmist is saying, and Lord, make my work meaningful. He begins with the exalted address. He goes to the brevity and the harshness of life, and he finally comes down to the fact that I'm not going to live very long. Life treats me pretty severely while I'm here, but you're great. You can do all things. One thing I wish you would do, make my work meaningful. Wherever you look in the Bible, you find working people. People who are busy rendering some kind of contribution. Noah is building a ship. Abraham has a far-flung workforce. Once when Lot was captured in a battle between kings in the region, Abraham took 318 servants and went after him and brought him back. You imagine with a man with enough flocks and herds that he has 318 people, able-bodied persons, taking care of those flocks and herds. David was a shepherd. He learned the hard work he needed for the king's job, caring for the sheep in a rather arid region. Amos was a prophet who would occasionally say, I'm not a prophet, but the son of a prophet. I'm a vine dresser. I'm a keeper of sheep. He was a man who'd learned to work with his hands. He was close to the soil. Oh, when you go into the New Testament, Jesus is not only called a carpenter's son, he's called a carpenter in Mark 6. He worked with his hands. The early church had its stories about the yokes he made that were easy for the oxen, about the wonderful things he could do in the carpenter's shop, whether it were true or not. So far as their knowing what he'd actually done in the carpenter's shop, he was a carpenter. He was a worker. Paul was a man who made tents. He had a right to the support of the churches. He refused that support on most occasions, because he chose to work and support himself with his own hands. The disciples of Jesus are usually pictured in art, stripped to the waist, pulling the nets, working with the boats. They're working men, and it's a good picture. There were people who'd learned the beauty of working with the hands. The text this morning talks to slaves. There were a lot of them in the early church. The early church was predominantly made up of lower classes of people. And more than half the people in the Roman Empire at one period were slaves. And as so many slaves came into the church, Paul could say, you work sometimes for a harsh, uncaring, unfeeling master. But don't work with eye service as if you were pleasing a man. Work as though working for God. Work because he's seeing what you do. In 1 Thessalonians, Paul has a good bit to say about work in both the Thessalonian letters. They'd apparently decided, some of them, I'm going to quit work. I'm going to wait for Jesus. It won't be long till he's back. There's no point in my busying myself with mundane things. And finally, they were having to depend on other people because they weren't working. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 4:11, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your own hands, just as we told you, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders and so that you will not be dependent on anybody. It's a strange description of the Christian lifestyle. Mind your own business, lead a quiet life, work with your own hands, win the respect of outsiders, don't be dependent on anybody. Sounds a long way from where we are, whether working with our own hands or leading a quiet life. There may be a key to happiness there. Wherever work is dealt with in Scripture, there's a relationship between faith and work. When we stop, we usually forget what holidays are for when they're a few years old. But if we do stop this Labor Day to think about it, the people we ought to appreciate, the meaning we ought to see in our own work, it's the relationship between faith and work that I hope you'll remember. From Genesis 1 on, it's there. God is described in Genesis 1 as working, and on the seventh day he rests from all he's created. By verse 28, he's telling man and woman whom he has brought into being that they should fulfill their mission by subduing the earth. In Genesis 2 and verse 15, he's telling them to be fruitful, to keep the garden, to till it. In Psalm 8, there's a reflection back to Genesis 1. As the psalmist notes that God has put everything that crawls on the earth, everything that passes through the paths of the sea under man's dominion. You can't escape if you look at what we might call a biblical doctrine of the creation. You can't escape the view that God has made us co-creators with him. He was the initial creator, but he left some of the work unfinished. He left tasks for you and me that are meaningful. And the Christian particularly is called into a relationship where he's a joint worker with God. Paul puts it that way in 1 Corinthians 3:9. We're fellow workers with God. You're God's vineyard. You're God's building. There's a rather frequent appeal for us to realize John 5:17. The Father works, Jesus said, and I work. That we're working together with God. That our activity is supposed to be meaningful. There's a relationship between faith and work. I don't know how one solves all the problems that face labor today, but I think the beginning place is seeing a relationship between what I do and faith in my life. William Carey, British missionary to India, shoe cobbler, said, "I cobble shoes to the glory of God." Probably you've heard some version of one of the Christopher Wren stories, the man who was the architect for St. Paul's Cathedral in London and several other of the beautiful buildings there. Story is that one day a man was passing by the work site and he stopped and talked with two or three of the workers. He asked one, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm carrying these bricks from here to over there and I carry these buckets of mortar as well." He passed to a second and asked, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I lay these bricks in a straight line. I'm shaping the mortar and the bricks together so that we have a stable wall, a stable structure." But he asked the third, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm helping Christopher Wren build St. Paul's Cathedral." He'd caught a glimpse of what was really being done. He was building something beautiful. Whatever you do, I hope you can see a way other people are served through it. And I suspect you can. The average American changes vocations 4 or 5 times in a lifetime today. And a lot of it's our quest for meaning. But once you come to see the meaning and make the daily relationship, a lot of which is yours, then part of that problem can be worked through. Karl Marx used to criticize religion. He said that religion was what kept the laborer down while he was exploited by the employer. There's been enough of that. There is enough of that. Paul addresses the employer, the master, and tells him how to treat the slave in the same section. But the thing that's overlooked is work is still meaningful. The work of my hands is what I want God to bless. Labor Day. If this year it makes us stop long enough to appreciate what others do for us, to examine the meaning in our own work, and to pray with meaning the prayer, "God, make my work meaningful." it would have been worthwhile. Do you need to serve Him, to obey His will, to give your life to Him so that He can work through you? Let us help you while we stand to sing and invite you.
Bye.